But then you'll want to insert 30 minutes of your music.
Oh, come on. That was a 15-second clip. It just sounded like it was 30.
Hello, it's spring 2020, and welcome to the New Academy podcast, a somewhat monthly series wherein we talk with specialized faculty in English about their professional lives. I'm Dave Morris.
And I'm Mary Lucille Hayes. Before we get started, we want to draw your attention to our event schedule for this semester, which you should have received in your email. You can also find it if you check the New Academy Series Facebook page or the website.
Be on the lookout, too, for two planned mini-episodes of the podcast, wherein we'll talk a little bit about the origin of the New Academy Series and about the teaching of English at U of I satellite programs in China, the latter of which will feature Mary this coming semester. Now, let's get to it.
Our guest today is Dave Morris.
I am. I've been avoiding this for the entire length of the podcast, so 2.5 years. So
your time has come.
My time has come.
You're in the hot seat now.
Dave is senior lecturer here in English. He teaches rhetoric, film, and literature, and he's interim co-director of professional writing. In research, Dave studies religion in contemporary literature, which is the subject of his book, Public Religions in the Future World, Post-Secularism and Utopia, forthcoming from University of Georgia Press.
Forthcoming, maybe a bit generous. It's under contract and currently under review.
Here to help me talk with Dave about his book project and everything else is our regular guest co-host, John Claiborne.
Hello, everybody, and I am totally standing for Dave right now. I love Dave.
We all love
Thank
Dave.
You, John.
And a new guest co-host, specifically selected due to his expertise in religion and literature, not to mention his familiarity with Dave's work, Patrick Fadley.
Hello, everybody. Glad to be here.
I'm so glad we're all here, except me.
Okay, so we're going to talk about Dave's book. Dave, what is the basic argument of your book?
That's a very good question, and I was thinking, for a lot of people, I think it's really hard to remember after one has written the whole book. But essentially, my argument is that religion has energized utopian literature and more broadly the utopian imagination in America for a long, long time. But I'm really looking at the last 40 years, and I have a small selection of texts. And my argument essentially beyond that is that when you look at religion as utopian, some really interesting things start to happen. We have a tendency in academic and public discourse to kind of understand religion pretty simply in relation to politics or in relation to social visions. You have sort of what we call strong religion, at least institutional, if not fundamentalist, that we tend to align with right politics. And then we have these kind of secularized religious forms, whether they're New Agey or they're kind of just gentler. And we tend to associate them with more left political movements. Mm. When we look at things through a utopian lens, we start to realize that a lot of those distinctions start to break down, and you start to see surprising alliances or at least convergences between, say, in my book, the Left Behind series and Carl Sagan's work. Or you start to see some theological similarities between the much more left visions of Octavia Butler and Left Behind. At the same time, where I think quite often Octavia Butler's work is read with Margaret Atwood's Matt Adams series, and rightly so, there's some really interesting divergences there that start to appear if we look at them both theologically and politically together. So my book is really interested in the implications of looking at religion and literature and religion and culture more generally through that utopian lens. It changes a lot of things.
So this is wrap my head around this. This is a really new idea to me, looking at religion through the lens of utopian, dystopian mm-hmm. literature. I was wondering, this may be kind of a dumb question, but would you say that all religions have some kind of utopian, dystopian vision?
That's a really good question. I don't know.
I mean, it's
but it's certainly
a blanket statement. I realize you can't.
Right. Well, partly because of, I mean, I'm really familiar with some religious traditions, a little familiar with others, and not at all with others. But what I would say is that take a part of a religion, whether it's an institution, whether it's a body of scripture, whether it's a set of practices, whether it's a set of beliefs, whatever, there's always going to be some vision of the world presented within it, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's utopian or not probably depends on when, where, and to whom you're looking, right? So one of the things that I found so fascinating in college about studying the Hebrew Bibles and the Christian Bibles together in historical ways is there's these massively utopian, politically resistant movements in there. If you're reading the prophets, for example, or if you're reading the Gospels, it's very much visions of revolution and the good life that come from overthrowing empires or whatever. But then there's also this incredible like nationalism that you get in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah or something like that. So I would say, which you could also read as utopian, but in a much more kind of what we would call, I think, a right-wing sort of way. So I think in any religious tradition, you are going to get all of these competing notions, all of these internal arguments and debates. And quite often, I think what is energizing them is either a disagreement about what constitutes a utopian vision, what do we look toward and why, or a disagreement about what are the means to that utopian vision that is largely shared.
Fascinating.
Yeah, so, you know, you choose a really interesting selection of texts in the book. So, as you already mentioned, Carl Sagan, Margaret Atwood is in there, Octavia Butler. Your last chapter is on
Willow Wilson, who's a contemporary author, largely of comic books.
And then also you talk about a book that, you know, I remember from my adolescence, Left Behind, which is a kind of a bizarre book. Can you explain what that book is in its broadest outlines for people who are unfamiliar with it?
So it's a series of, it was originally supposed to be 12 books, like the 12 tribes of Israel in the Bible. And kind of like the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy trilogy, it ballooned. And I think it was 14 or 15 books, if I remember, because there were prequels and whatnot. But basically, it's a novelization, and they are certainly not the first to do this. There's a long 20th century history of making novelizations out of a theology called premillennial dispensationalism. Without going into a lot of details of that, probably listeners would know about the rapture and know about the different visions of the end times, you know, whether there'll be an antichrist who rises to power and that sort of thing. So Left Behind at its core is a novelization of that theological eschatology, right, of that that narrative of what will come at the end. It's also a, for lack of a better word, conservative vision, socially conservative vision of the good life that is lost, which seems to be suburban Chicago nuclear family. Kids, marriage, very pretty conservative gender roles, that sort of thing. It's also an evangelizing tract, like, hey, everybody, this is what the Bible says, now come get saved. It's also a political tract, you know, be very, very, very cautious about any peacemakers or globalization or the United Nations in those books are much more powerful than they are now.
What's the name of the character that comes to power over the United Nations?
Nikolai Carpathia.
Nikolai Carpathia. That just sounds...
Well, so there's... So interestingly,
evil name.
Left Behind is also an internal debate over what evangelization should look like, whether you should care about social issues, whether Christians should care about poverty, should care about oppression, or do they just save souls. But there's also really arcane theological debates, like where does the Bible say the Antichrist comes from?
Right.
You know, which was part of a bigger debate in the 70s and 80s. Is it Ronald Reagan? Is it Saddam Hussein? Is it, you know, whichever person we don't like at any given moment is the Antichrist? And so they were kind of making a theological argument that the Antichrist definitely comes from Eastern Europe. Which is really arcane to outside readers. Yeah. but this was a thing that they argued
about. Well, what's remarkable about that, too, you know, and based on your description, is what a massive publishing event it was. I think it was on the New York Times bestseller list.
Each one was for quite a while.
Yeah, yep. And it had this real popular culture kind of moment of success, made it into a couple of movies.
Yes.
And it became a mainstay of evangelical culture.
Uh-huh.
You know, of sort of white evangelical culture in the United States. And so
for a good 20 years.
Yeah, a solid 20 years. And so I wonder if you have thoughts about whether, you know, I wonder if you have thoughts about it as a cultural product in addition to what it actually, the contents of the book.
It's so fascinating. And really, of all the texts in the study, Left Behind is the one that I started thinking about first, largely because in the late 90s, when my father joined a fundamentalist church, it was the first novel he read in 30 years. And, you know, just so people know, my father has 3 college degrees. He's not, you know, an uneducated person. He just doesn't like to read. And not novels, anyway. And so, you know, I started thinking about that then. I started thinking about college. And then, obviously, during the Bush administration and after 9/11, it became very, very important. But Left Behind itself, which seems so politically aggressive and which seems regressive, too. It seems like it's part of these conservative movements that we recognize are also theologically really interesting because they're reaching into this supposedly secular environment, trying to colonize it. Like, hello, secular people, here we are. Come give us a look.
Yeah, we know your cultural forms.
Exactly.
We can entertain you, too.
But the reverse is the other side, too, which is, okay, internal readers going to Christian bookstores, going to Christian book clubs, you don't have to give up anything. Do you know what I mean? Not really, anyway. Here is your entertaining literature. Don't read the secular entertaining literature. Read our entertaining literature. Don't go to rec leagues to play soccer. Come to our sports park. So the church my dad was a part of had a sports park. It was called the Grace and Truth Sports Park.
Sure.
I called it the Jesus Christ Memorials Park, Sports Park, which is a really weird, complicated death of God joke. But but this is really, and then Christian rock, of course, which really becomes popular in the 90s, where it's kind of
I remember Creed.
Creed. Lord. Yeah. Well, Creed is a different matter, but
Creed is my favorite. Well,
you know,
Christian rock.
Jars of Clay, the ones that didn't cross over, you know, there's this whole environment, where you can have all the culture, and then the Christian movies, like the Left Behind movie starring Kirk Cameron and whatnot, you can have this. It's a kind of white flight, right? Come to the suburb where everybody's like you. Well, this is kind of like this. Come to the organization where everybody's like you. We will have a parallel a parallel culture.
A utopian parallel culture?
Very much, right? And where what defines the utopia is that it's very clear who's in and who's out. It's very clear who's recognized and who isn't, right? And while I think that they were in theory open to everyone, we know in practice that that doesn't work.
Right.
So that, I think, is what is the long-lasting influence of Left Behind? It is part of a bigger culture of identitarian definition, right? So they might not be white supremacists in the same way that a lot of the ones we're hearing from now are. But when your utopian vision is a world where everything is crystal damn clear, where the lines are, where the moral lines are, and those moral lines are between people, we know who's in and who's out, then the dystopia, the thing that the Antichrist does, is the collapsing of boundaries. We don't have national boundaries anymore. Everybody, there's only one military, and it's the quote-unquote peacekeeping force, although the speed with which the Antichrist starts nuking things is remarkable in the series. As one Presbyterian pastor I read wrote, it's like, yes, he's a pacifist, but it's worth noting he's not a very good one. this is, what is Left Behind's lasting impact? It's part of this growth of culture toward the identitarian and the lines being drawn there, the who instead of the what.
I love this quote about Left Behind in your book. You say, it's so easy to make fun of Left Behind.
It is very hard not to make fun of
Left Behind. Yeah, it's hard not to.
Yeah.
But you say, you take it seriously and you counter that tendency a lot in your book. And I love this quote. Quote, Left Behind does offer some conceptual hope for utopian thinking. The series asks for commitment to something bigger than themselves, the belief that people can serve something beyond their immediate interests, experiences, pleasures, and therapeutic personal fulfillments. Mm-hmm. And I love that passage, and I was just wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more on that, I guess.
Well, I'm glad you asked, because one of the things I thought about when you asked me earlier, sort of what's the argument of the book, I kind of left out part of it, which is, one of the things that all of these contemporary utopian visions and dystopian visions have in common, no matter what political or social or theological lens they're looking through, is a dissatisfaction with the communal fragmentation and the monetization of neoliberalism,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So Left Behind on one side, you know, fits perfectly within it. I mean, what is so cool about these characters? They're jet pilots, they got money, you know, they can eat at the finest restaurants. And there's even an article a guy wrote called Invest in Jesus, where he says the logic of this series is like, look, invest in Jesus, it will pay off with heaven, you know, but also it'll pay off, like, because economically successful people are Christians, right? But on the other hand, there's this underside to it, which is this kind of gnawing knowledge that there's no satisfaction or there's no genuine connection in that life. So, you know, in the first novel, when Rayford Steele, the main character, when he comes home to find his wife and his son have been raptured, and he's in this beautiful house, totally alone, going around crying as he looks at all the things that, all the beautiful house his wife has made. Let's not get too far into that, but it's you know, pretty frustrating. The idea is, what made this a beautiful house? Well, for one thing, it's his wife's proper gendered femininity, but for another, it's that they all lived there together, right? And he didn't appreciate that. And so he promises that he's not going to make the same mistake with his daughter. And then where does he find the truest friends and family he's ever had is when he goes to the church, when he learns about these things, and then they team up to fight the Antichrist, which is interesting because I think in other Christian novels, maybe people would team up to evangelize or to make the world a better place, but for them, it's to fight an enemy. Nonetheless, what I'm trying to sort of generously say is, this is an expression of a desire for community that transcends this suburb that they live in, even if that suburb is heaven.
Mm. Yes.
Which it kind of is to them.
Yeah.
But
community, yeah.
It's so there's a, what do we call it? I think I would call it a dialectic here between this tension of this great enjoyment of neoliberalism and the buying of the meritocracy. Like, why does Rayford have, like, these nice things? Because he's so damn great. Now it's time to take his greatness, his awesomeness, his competence with technology, his power, his dude power, and we're going to turn it toward fighting the Antichrist. So it's deeply problematic, but it also recognizes the same problem that Butler's novels and Atwood's novels recognize as well.
Well, that reminds me of something I wanted to ask you about. And I paid most attention to the Atwood chapter, and I will say it really made me want to go back and read Atwood again. So I'm kind of excited.
You've read Oryx and Crake, right?
That's actually the only one in that series I read. I haven't read the other two. So I'm going to go back and read the whole series. Anyway, as I was reading that chapter, I was wondering, I wanted to ask you, do you think that dystopian novels in general are optimistic or pessimistic?
That's a good question, and that sort of, I think, dovetails with something Patrick and I were talking about a little bit earlier. And the answer is, I don't know. It depends. And other people have written about this. With Left Behind, right, they have and I come out of the same sort of Calvinist tradition, they have this long theological tradition of total depravity, right? People are not better. Like, they cannot be made better. They are inherently sinful. But there's always this desire to find a way around that, right? What can we do? So one scholar, Glenn Chuck, calls it opening the post-millennial crack in the window of premillennialism. Don't worry, that's pretty abstract. But and what I would say is both. Mm-hmm. They are both optimistic and pessimistic. There is another scholar, Jerry Canavan, likes to say that Octavia Butler longed to write utopian fiction but just couldn't bring herself to do it. Like, mm-hmm. So there is always this tension in all of these. And I also see it as wild as some of this imagining is, there's something distinctly pragmatist to it. It's kind of like, well, we all might be horrible, but here we are. What's next, right? What's next? And for some of them, left behind in Octavia Butler, there's a kind of withdrawal involved, right? And for Margaret Atwood, you know, in the Mad Adam series, almost everybody on Earth has to die of plague before we can really imagine something genuinely new. Whereas Carl Sagan may be the most optimistic, you know. Everyone gets educated, science is democracy, we become super beings and aliens. And for Willow Wilson, too, I mean, there's an optimism to her work, too, that suggests that a kind of Islamic piety changes the way one looks at other people in the world as it forms a kind of solidarity across difference. So everybody is trying to think, okay, we have these conflicts, all of these works, we have these conflicts. What settles or at least makes those conflicts non-destructive? So for Butler, it's nothing settles the conflicts. The question is, how do you adapt to them, right? So she's very evolutionary. For Atwood, it's really disaster all the way down, and maybe something can grow out of the ashes of that. For Left Behind, it's Jesus comes back and says, I was right all along. And for Carl Sagan, it's, I don't know, you know, again, an outside intervention. The aliens announce themselves and everything potentially
contact,
gets better.
Yeah. You talk about contact specifically. Yeah. And that's, we discover, we make contact with aliens.
Exactly.
Right? I just know the movie.
Yeah. Yeah, and well, the movie's a little, but not, there's a lot less discussion of math in the movie than there is in the books, but there are similarities.
But with Sagan, making contact with aliens is like fulfilling that desire for God.
It fulfills the desire for God, but it also...
It unites humanity.
Exactly. Everyone's God. So in the movie Contact, Jodie Foster goes to the center of the galaxy by herself. Mm. In the book, she does not. She goes in a national coalition with a Soviet scientist, an Indian scientist, a Nigerian scientist, and then one other person I can never remember. And so it's much, and they all go and they meet these alien forms of their lost loved ones and everything. So it's both intimate and alien at the same time. That is something that the movie loses. The movie is about personal because it's Bob Zemeckis. So we're, you know, only dreaming of the personal development of the white character. But,
I cry at the end of that movie.
Yeah. Well, in Carl Sagan, you know, the book ends with Ellie finding the message from the designers of the universe hidden in the mathematical concept of pi, right? Mm. So the notion is, you know, there is a God, but the God is much more Benjamin Franklin's God, you know, the God, the designer, than Ronald Reagan's God, whatever the hell was going on there. So, I don't know where I was going with that, but... So are they pessimistic or optimistic? The answer is both, all of them.
Mm-hmm. So that kind of leads to a question that I was going to ask also. And it has to do with, I think, so you work in your book with a pretty broad definition of utopia.
Mm-hmm.
And it can include things like dystopia.
Sure.
Like what other people might call dystopia within the broad umbrella.
Absolutely.
And you might encounter, and I wonder what you would say to an argument that goes something like, you know, we have to, in order to preserve what's special about utopian literature in particular, we need to hive it off from this religious stuff. Because what's central to utopian literature is as Mary was talking about, a positive vision of the human being, mm-hmm. which is perfectible if only we could get these crazy social institutions right. You know, and so yeah. in order to preserve that humanistic core, when, you know, some people might say we got to hive off this religious stuff about your double predestination and your total depravity. So what would you say to somebody like that? Or do you think that's not very useful?
A few things. First of all, I mean, I, as you know as well as anybody, that, you know, the secular always has the trace of the religious in it. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm thinking of Talal Asad's work on secularization, right, and concepts of pain, right? And non-secular pain might be a punishment for sin. Mm-hmm. But in a secular form, pain is a punishment for not taking care of yourself properly, which is sin, you know? and I write about this in Margaret Atwood's chapter, right? So Crake, the scientist in Oryx, and Crake, who unleashes the plague and who makes the super people who are going to take the place of people, is a wholly secular atheist person, but everything has to do with sin. Humankind is inherently sinful against the environment. Mm. We are wired, and there's some with Octavia Butler with this too, we are wired to destroy everything, basically. Mm-hmm. And so what is Crake's intervention is to play God, and I mean, this is all over the book, you know, it's they're in the Paradise Dome, he calls it the Eden Project, or the Paradise Project in the Eden Dome, and, you know, and he's going to recreate humankind into this race of weird super people.
Intelligent design.
Mm-hmm. Basically, yes. Mm-hmm. But the idea is I can design out sin, right? Mm-hmm. He doesn't say sin, but this is what he's talking yeah. about. Mm-hmm. So there's always that trace of the secular. I will also say this. One of the things that I've come to recognize, and I'll get personal here, and because this is a podcast, and obviously I wouldn't do that in a job interview or anything. But I've come to recognize how much in the last 10 years my own thinking about everything comes out of my Presbyterian background. Mm-hmm. And also, it turns out when I do some genealogical research, literally 400 years of Dutch Calvinism in my family. It's apparently just in my genes. But, I, as a Presbyterian, grow out of this Calvinist tradition, and very secular, very largely atheist Presbyterian. I grow out of this Calvinist tradition of believing in total depravity. And in that we all, to some degree, really suck. Mm. But for me, that is the basis of solidarity. That is, and this is why it was so appealing to so many people in the 18th century, I think, is any difference between us in rank, in level, in wealth is chance. Because underneath it all, we are totally the same. There is no, sorry, Joel Osteen, there is no yes. sign. There is no sign of the favor of God or the favor of genetics, Donald Trump Jr., or, you know, the favor of anything like that. Everything is chance because deep down, any kind of salvation, any kind of theological good or supernatural good or extra human good that we have in us is so far out of our understanding that it's rendered irrelevant. Mm-hmm. What we have is our depravity, and it is therefore our responsibility to work through it as best we can. Yeah. This is partly why I like Octavia Butler, is that she has a version of this too. Right? It is our responsibility. So to me, that depravity, that lack of perfectibility, is the core, the beginning of utopia. Of community, exactly, and of responsibility to do that. You have to press...
That's a great answer.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Well, and I would also say this, you know, in my own life, I study utopia, but I am a frustratingly pragmatic person, I think you guys know, and as I think, I mean, it causes me trouble with my family sometimes because I'm just such an annoyingly pragmatic person, largely because of diabetes more than anything else. Mm-hmm. And that tension between... hope, between the demand to work together to make things better, and also knowing that you have to keep living in the place that sucks.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You have to keep living in the non-ideal.
Yeah.
You know, that grows out of a sort of weirdly secularized theology too of what, you know, what do you do with suffering? What do you do with depravity? Well, number one, you have to withstand it. And number two, you have to try to alleviate it. So I guess this is a roundabout way of answering your question, Patrick, is saying that I don't necessarily think of those two things as lack of perfectibility as an impediment to utopian thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there you go.
Well, speaking of depravity, in your conclusion, you bring up
I see what this
our POTUS.
Okay.
You ask, how could a movement, evangelical movement, historically preoccupied with pietistic notions of sexual chastity, pious speech, and nuclear family stability embrace a thrice married, I love this writing here, by the way, embrace a thrice married serial philanderer known for dishonest business behavior and unapologetic pridefulness. And of course, a lot of people in the mainstream media and newspapers and such have written countless articles explain why evangelical Christians support Trump. And I was wondering, what's your take on that? What is your intervention?
Well, first of all, I think that evangelical support for Trump, you know, I'm always suspicious of any kind of demographic support, you know, do college students like this person, do black folks like this person, you know.
Yeah.
I feel like that kind of thinking is more good for 24-hour news analysts than the rest of us. But, you know, I understand why you're asking. I did write about this. And the answer is, when you look at, the point I'm trying to make is, when you look at this through the lens not of religion and not of, is there a matchup between religious concern and this person's behavior? Is there a match between theology and this person's anti-theology, maybe? I don't know what to call it with Trump. If you look at it through utopia, you know, what is the horrifying genius of the phrase, make America great again? Well, for one thing, its emptiness of content allows you to project almost any kind of utopia or dystopia onto it, right? And so, you know, what does he offer? Well, for one thing, like Ronald Reagan before him, he offers recognition. It's like, those people are as important as they think they are, right? And that's amazing. We were talking about this before. You were saying Elizabeth Warren kind of offers the same thing to us, you know?
It's the intellectual.
Hey,
law professor, you know.
Knowing shit matters. You know, at the same time, you know, what is Make America Great Again is a utopian statement. And it is one that incorporates a nostalgia that the new Christian right, not Christianity, not evangelical Christianity, not even fundamentalist Christianity, but the new Christian right specifically has been drawing on for decades. Mm-hmm. The idea that not just there is an ideal Christian, there is an ideal America, right? And it starts with the pilgrims who were probably much different than we imagined they were. But nonetheless, you know, what were these people like? Pious, brave, and most importantly, as far as we're willing to say, the only people here. Mm-hmm. You know? Now, of course, we know just through Anne Hutchinson and John Winthrop that it wasn't that simple. They didn't even get along with themselves, right?
Yeah.
But nonetheless, you know, what do we hearken back to? A time when nobody told us in the biggest senses that we were wrong. Now, of course, again, that's not true. But we imagine that, right? And so what Make America Great Again does, and what Donald Trump, despite his personality, offers to all of these different groups of people is a loud, resounding, your vision of the world is at least mostly correct. And when you feel like everybody else who's telling you is you're wrong is also resounding and also clever and also devastating, you know, then it appears, and just so people know, please don't think I'm trying to say that these things are equal, because I'm not. I'm not trying to draw a false equivalence. I'm just saying that looking at Trumpism through the lens of utopian thinking, kind of flattens these religious differences and shows us that the utopian visions are similar, even if the theologies or the pieties are not.
Mm-hmm. Can I add something or just sure. try to draw a little further on that? Because so Trump is also outside of the culture. He's at war with, in the same way that the Left Behind stuff,
sure.
and there's a whole alternative utopian cultural form.
Mm-hmm.
He is great for that because who does he hate? Hollywood. You know, he's yes. always in a squabble with some sort of...
Rosie O'Donnell.
Yeah. And the New York Times,
yeah.
right? And all of mm-hmm. the, quote-unquote, liberal cultural institutions, mm-hmm. that's his... for a long time has been his punching bag.
Absolutely, which is
And
funny,
yet he's, you know, yeah. but, dependent
but,
on
but
it,
But what
too.
The utopianism does is it renders it moot that he was also... Why does everybody know him? Because he had his own reality TV show.
Yeah,
you know
yeah,
what
and
I mean?
Commercials.
So that contradiction is resolved by exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we probably shouldn't spend the whole time talking about DJT, but...
DJT. Yeah. So, should we talk about the process?
Sure. Whatever.
So, yeah, what's this book's origin story, Dave? You kind of got a little bit
yeah,
from your Presbyterian background.
Right. And it started in the 90s with right at the same time that my dad was joining that church and reading Left Behind. I took a course in college, so this is around the year 2000, with called Literature of the Bible, which is a little different than Bible as Literature. And it was taught by a guy named Ken Gross, who's a relatively well-known early modernist and Shakespeare scholar. He wrote Shakespeare's Noise and a variety of other things, the Essay on Puppetry. And this was probably the moment I started thinking about going to grad school. Because, for one thing, he was just a funny guy. He used to read the Psalms and Job in this whiny Woody Allen voice that made us all laugh all the time. But this was the first time I really started to learn to historicize these things. I had read scripture before, but not in such a systematic way and not in a literary way. And as the Christian right was really gaining power and then eventually culminating with, let's call it generously, the election of George W. Bush. And then there was 9/11. And these all of these things sort of came together. And so I started thinking about Christian fundamentalism. That's what this began as. And then it slowly evolved into looking at other science fiction that addressed religion in some way, and that's where the dissertation was. The utopia part of it is post-dissertation I started to think about basically how to make this a little bit more coherent, and that was the missing element. So that sort of came in, and that's what I've been doing for the past 5 or 6 years. At American Studies Association conference a couple of years ago, I was in a panel, and you guys know how conference panels go. There were two, maybe three people in the audience. And one of them, Lynn Itagaki, is editing a series on post-1970 culture and history for University of Georgia Press. She asked me if I had a book proposal. I said, as it happens, yes. And then we just went from there. So, which is, I think important to note for people who haven't published academic books. Academic presses really want to publish books, so if you have a good idea and you can say it coherently in a proposal, someone will be interested. There's this whole thing in academia where we're still thinking in terms of like rank. You know, it's like, I'm not a professor. Will they want to work with me? Nobody asked me what my rank was. Uh-huh. Nobody.
And was this part of a series?
Yeah, the post-1970s culture and history.
Okay, yeah.
And I just think this is important to note. Mm-hmm. I think probably being a professor at a place like this and getting a research fund and sabbatical certainly would have helped. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to downplay that at all. I'm just saying don't overestimate the importance of your position within the academy. Think about what you have to say and how, and whether you actually want to write a book.
Yes.
Which was a big question for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did you grapple with that question? What was the deciding moment?
You know, I really don't remember.
Yeah.
I think it was at a moment where I just didn't know what direction I wanted to head in, mm-hmm. Professionally, I mean. And I think I just had to think, you know, do I think at least a small number of people would be interested in reading this book? Mm-hmm. Because it's an academic book, it's not like a ton of people are going to read it. Mm-hmm. You know, do I think this is worth saying? And I got some definite encouragement. I mean, Trish Lagren has been telling me for years this is a timely project and mm-hmm. worth doing. And you yeah. know, and you, John, and certainly Dana, and Gwen, my wife, certainly said, you know, essentially, why not? What's stopping you? Do you have something way more important to spend your time on? And that, I think,
makes life more interesting.
Exactly. and this was, I think this is, like, what else, what exactly else did I want to do? I don't have big hobbies, you know? So, yeah.
Can you talk about the mechanics of being an NTT and doing your job and teaching and writing a book at the same time? Like, how did you balance that? Did you compartmentalize your writing time or what?
Fortunately, most of the research for this book was already done mm-hmm. over the past several years. So I wrote during the summer. Mm-hmm. And a little bit during other times, you know, and you guys know how it starts. You know, if you start the semester and you're teaching courses you've already taught for the first few weeks, you can continue on whatever you were doing in the summer or mm-hmm. break. But, you know, at some point, it starts to fall apart.
Yeah.
So certainly, it was compartmentalized like that. Mm-hmm. I don't... You know, I've said a million times, I was not productive as a grad student. But it was not because of my teaching load. It was because of my poor health insurance. Mm-hmm. So all summers I had to get extra jobs. Yeah. I had to do a variety of things, the AP grading, obviously, but a bunch of other things, too. That is what prevented me, that economic precarity.
That's real, what we need Medicare for all.
Well, yes. Absolutely. But real health insurance. But this is the point I'm making. You're right. Yeah. Real health insurance and a living wage is what made the biggest difference.
Yeah.
Now, on top of that, now thanks to the NTFC, we have a little bit of research money, which I promptly used because going to conferences helps too, and I sure as heck wasn't going to self-fund that. Mm-hmm. So I'm making – the point I'm trying to make here is you can do things with little resources, but resources help. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm, yeah, tremendously.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the cool things that's come out of some of this is I've gotten to go to more conferences, and now I'm getting invited to do things. You know, I'm organizing and doing a panel at ALA in the spring on religion and utopia. So, you know, things are happening, and that's pretty cool.
So what's your next book project going to be?
I told you, no job interview questions. Well, but I can answer that for you.
Well, like, what are your...
Yeah, I don't know what the next book project was going to be. I'm kicking around a few different things. But I think the area that I've only sort of brushed against in this book that I'm really interested in is disability. That... Certainly it comes out in Octavia Butler, and somebody's written a really great book. Sammy Schock wrote a book called Body Minds Reimagined, where she talks about Octavia Butler and disability quite a bit. But I've started to think more and more about people's... This book is really conceptual, right? Mm-hmm. And I've started to think more in the last 2 years about people's embodied experiences of these... ideological visions, right? So what do we wish for utopia? How is that influenced by, but also how does that influence the way we look at our actual physical experience and emotional experience and mental experience of the world? You know, and thinking, I've been thinking more about my own experience as a diabetic with a, you know, a somewhat invisible disability. I didn't even think of it as a disability until a couple of years ago, until somebody told me it was. And yeah, I was like, what? No, it's, well, okay. You know, that makes sense. Yeah. And so I think that might be the next direction, is to think about disability in regard to this question of religion and utopia. Yeah. So I guess adding a third term to what I'm already doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like a great project.
Yeah.
We'll see. We can speak with ambition in this kind of environment. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I can edit this out.
Should we wrap at that point?
Yeah.
You know, just as a side note, that's already in Thomas More's Utopia. So,
I know,
so he,
yeah.
Yeah, you know that. Yep. He deals with disabled people. In
yeah, and he deals
already.
With crime. And,
yeah.
You know, I was thinking about actual utopias, too. I was thinking about The Dispossessed.
Mm-hmm.
Ursula Le Guin kind of gets into some of that.
Yeah, but, yeah. It's one of the primary continuing differences. Like, if the goal is to homogenize and make everybody into, like, a big communal collective...
You still got the person with the lame
leg.
Still
got biology.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so should we do a wrap-up?
Was there anything else you guys wanted to ask?
Let me...
You guys are pros around here. I'm deeply impressed by your...
Well, Dave and I have been talking about his book, and I've been reading his drafts and everything.
I mean, you didn't ask about teaching. That's the only thing. And, you know, all this weirdo administration work that I'm doing. but it's up to you guys. You can. I know you like to ask about that.
Yeah.
Do you want? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's wrap it up with that.
Cut.
Okay, John. Start recording here. Now.
Okay. So... as a follow-up to the question about balance, how do you balance your teaching with your writing, your research, and everything else you do? And the New Academy, you do a lot of stuff in the department.
Yeah, I do. While I was writing, I started to get a little better at saying no to mm-hmm. things. Mm-hmm. But I would say... So very little of this project... directly ends up in my teaching, right? I don't walk into my Rep 105 class and be like, hey, let's talk about premillennial dispensationalism today.
it's probably for the best.
You know, I mean, a little bit. So I taught Children of Men in film and a tiny bit, but it's really tangential, and doing Station 11 in English 200 this semester, and I'm excited about that. But I would say, you know, again, back to this question of utopianism, and I'd love to tell you I create a utopia in my classroom, but I just don't. That's a lie. But I would go back again to that question of, you know, the utopian ideal, the thing that you're reaching for, the thing that you wish for, the thing that you want to make, and that stubborn pragmatism of you still live in the world. And that certainly shows up in my rec class, right? As I talk with students, and for those of you who haven't taught 105, you know, for a lot of us, it's we start right at the beginning of the semester. What are you interested in? What do you care about? What do you love? How do you research that area? How do you make an inquiry that makes sense? And then once you figure out what you want to know, what is a research method that makes sense for it? Mm-hmm. So, you know, in some ways this kind of sounds really like a bummer, but what I'm trying to do is take the students' loves, passions, angers, frustrations, concerns about the world, and bring them down into something doable, into something that they can make something out of or do something about, mm-hmm. you know. And that certainly grows out of how I think about this same question of what's the relationship between these big conceptual ideas and the actual world as it is, mm-hmm. and how these authors address that question. Mm-hmm. So that certainly shows up in my rec class like that. Whereas in the literature classes, the rare times I get to teach them, that's fun. You can be a little bit more abstract. You can talk about big issues in different ways. So that shows up in various ways. So I guess the short answer is indirectly this influences my teaching a lot, mm-hmm. not in a way that I directly talk about with most of the students. Because we all know, I mean, we had that teacher who was like, let's talk about my dissertation for a semester. And it's just a terrible idea.
Yeah.
It's a disservice.
Turning into that teacher.
Well, no, I know.
Because I think
you really are, yeah. But.
No, I'm joking.
Yeah.
But you are going to require your students to buy your book, when it comes.
Oh, to sure. Yeah. Well,
I understand, yeah. Children of Men. You need to read my book.
Yeah, right.
Cover to cover.
Right. Yeah, cover to cover.
I always liked what Bob Parker does, which is he assigns his own textbook, but then he very carefully calculates exactly how much money he would make off them buying it, and then donates it to charity. So, I think that's really considerate and thoughtful and respectful.
Or give it back to the students.
Yeah. I mean, you could do that. That's kind of complicated, but.
Socialist.
Here's $1.25 for
like what?
So, anyway, there we are.
All right, Dave. Well, thanks for taking the time to chat with us about your book.
This was fun, and I'm glad we could fit it in before Mary jets off to China.
Yeah, and I'd like to thank Patrick as well for being a guest.
Yeah, thanks to y'all, and just love the book, Dave. So it was nice talking with you about it.
Don't forget to check out our series.
When is your lecture?
Oh, sorry, great question.
Yeah, you got anything to plug?
Yes. So, I think this is a really good point, and hopefully you can edit around a little bit of this weirdness. Mm-hmm. But don't miss our upcoming events this semester. I'm going to give a talk on this on February 7th, which is a Friday, day before my 40th birthday.
Woo.
From 3 to 4:15 or so in English Building 160. And then on March 6th, we're going to hear from one of our newer colleagues, Pallavi Gupta, is going to talk about her work on Jane Eyre. On Friday, the 6th of March, yep, also at 3 o'clock in room 160. And then on April 3rd, also a Friday, we'll hear from